1,969 Texans are in the hospital for the coronavirus as of August 1st, 858 less than a week ago. They occupy 16.4% of hospital beds. 9,539 new cases were reported on August 1st. There were 78,027 viral tests reported on July 31st. That made the positivity rate 12%. 6,837 Texans have died as of August 1st, 268 more deaths reported than the day before, and 1,544 more than a week ago. West Texas Intermediate crude is trading at $41.12, up 86 cents. Now here are coronavirus briefs for this Monday, August 3rd. These are from the Washington Post as well as CNN. President Trump on Monday tweeted criticism of Deborah Birx, the physician overseeing the White House's coronavirus response, a day after she warned that the United States is entering a new phase of the pandemic. Trump tweeted that after House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, Democrat, California, criticized Birx for being too positive on his handling of the pandemic, the doctor took the bait and hit us. He appeared to be referring to Birx on Sunday, telling CNN that increasing outbreaks in both rural and urban areas are different from March and April and extraordinarily widespread. Alaska, Hawaii, Missouri, Montana, and Oklahoma are among the states witnessing the largest surge of infections over the past week, according to a Washington Post analysis of health data. Experts also see worrying trends emerging in major East Coast and Midwest cities, and they anticipate major outbreaks in college towns as classes resume in August. Here are some significant developments. At least 4,641,000 coronavirus cases and 151,000 fatalities have been reported in the United States since February. Close to 50,000 new cases and 478 deaths were reported Sunday, a day of the week when numbers are often artificially low because some jurisdictions do not report data. The prospects for a new relief package and a deal that would restore $600 a week emergency unemployment benefits look dismal. White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows said Sunday that he was not optimistic that there will be a solution in the very near term, while Pelosi and Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin made clear in separate interviews that they were nowhere near reaching a consensus. World Health Organization Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus threw some cold water on rising hopes for a vaccine that will be safe and effective, saying that there's no silver bullet at the moment and there might never be. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said Democrats want to extend the federal $600 unemployment insurance provisions in the next stimulus bill, adding that she is not willing to negotiate the amount. I think that the number, the $600, is related more to the unemployment rate. If the unemployment goes down, then the number can go down, she said. You're not saying to the American people, we have more infections, we have more deaths, we have more unemployment, we have more hunger, and now we're going to cut your benefit. That's just not going to happen. She criticized Republicans for pushing for cuts to the $600 amount in federal unemployment insurance. Top executives at Disney, Microsoft, MasterCard, and IBM are among the 100 business leaders calling on Congress to provide emergency relief for small businesses facing economic calamity. In a letter sent to congressional leaders of both parties on Monday, the executives issued a dire warning of mass business closures triggered by the coronavirus as companies report plummeting revenue and face the prospect of shutting down yet again to contain the outbreak. The signatories put forward a series of recommendations, including federally guaranteed loans to last into 2021, flexibility in how those loans are put to use, partial loan forgiveness for small and mid-sized companies that have suffered significant revenue declines, and a focus on funding for businesses owned by people of color who have less access to funding. More than 4 million businesses have received emergency loans from the Small Business Administration, with Congress approving $700 billion in funding to support them. But for the 30 million small businesses in the country, that funding was too limited and short-lived, business leaders say. The letter calls for a more robust and sustained effort from the federal government. Governors nationwide are urging the Trump administration to extend National Guard deployments to assist with the coronavirus response ahead of another deadline. In late May, President Trump extended federal funding for National Guard deployments until mid-August, saying at the time the extension would help states succeed in their response and recovery efforts. But in order to meet COVID-19 safety requirements, Air and Army Guard supporting personnel will need to demobilize no later than Friday, according to a defense official. That's raising alarm among governors who are preparing for the possibility that an extension is not granted. While we appreciate the administration's support over the past few months, short-term extensions and last-minute authorizations are adversely impacting and disrupting state plans and operations, the National Governors Association said in a statement Monday. Governors strongly urged the president to authorize an extension of Title 32 today. Unnecessary delays in extending Title 32 create significant challenges for states and territories, which are amplified in the middle of the crisis. Title 32 status provides federal funding for the National Guard deployments across the country, while allowing those forces to remain under the control of state governors as they help with staffing community-based testing sites, building test kits, among other activities. CNN reported Friday that the Trump administration is weighing an extension. A defense official told CNN that the Defense Department is expecting an extension, but it's sitting at the White House. Students are returning back to school in some parts of the U.S., and plans to keep the coronavirus out of schools are already showing some cracks. An Indiana junior high school student tested positive on the first day back, after attending class for part of the day. Another student in Mississippi tested positive after the first week of classes. And Georgia's largest school district confirmed that at least 260 employees have either tested positive for COVID-19 or have been exposed. School reopenings will have to be done carefully, Dr. Deborah Burke said, and areas that have reported a rise of infections should first stop cases before engaging in talks about welcoming students back to class. If you have high caseloads and active community spread, just like we are asking people not to go to bars, not to have household parties, not to create large spreading events, we are asking people to distance, learn at this moment, so we can get this pandemic under control, she said. Eli Lilly and Company said Monday it is moving into a Phase 3 clinical trial of its antibody treatment for COVID-19. The Indianapolis-based pharmaceutical giant said that it plans to recruit 2,400 residents and staff at long-term care facilities for its trial. Nursing home residents and staff are particularly vulnerable to severe forms of COVID-19. As of July 30th, there have been nearly 63,000 deaths in long-term care facilities, accounting for at least 44% of total deaths in 43 states, according to the Kaiser Family Foundation. That percentage is very likely an undercount. In June, Lilly became the first company in the U.S. to start testing an antibody therapy in humans. LYCOV555, as it's called, was created by Lilly in cooperation with Abcellera from an antibody first identified in a blood sample taken from one of the first U.S. patients to recover from COVID-19. With this trial, the company will work with the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases and the COVID-19 Prevention Network to administer the therapy to residents and staff at several long-term care facilities that have recently diagnosed cases of COVID-19. The hope is that this antibody therapy will provide protection and possibly ease symptoms for those who do get infected. Tailored Brands, the owner of Men's Warehouse, and Joseph A. Bank filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy, becoming the latest U.S. retail casualty of the pandemic. Tailored Brands said in a statement that it voluntarily filed Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection on Sunday in the U.S. bankruptcy court in Houston due to the unprecedented impact of COVID-19. The company expects its four retail brands to continue to operate during the restructuring process and said it has reached an agreement with lenders to reduce debt by $630 million. This follows Tailored Brands' decision on July 21st to eliminate about 20% of its corporate workforce and close up to 500 stores as it deals with a challenging retail environment. Lord & Taylor also filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection on Sunday, according to court documents. From the Associated Press, Texas doesn't report COVID-19 case count amid system upgrade. Texas did not report daily counts of COVID-19 cases nor fatalities Sunday as health officials worked to upgrade the electronic system they use to process lab reports. The Texas Department of State Health Services said the Sunday counts will be published Monday after the scheduled upgrade is completed. And now we'll go to one of our first recorded reports today. This is the columnist Ross Ramsey, based in Austin. From the Texas Tribune, analysis. August agenda for local government includes schools, police spending, and property taxes, and a pandemic.
This is Ross Ramsey's Unconventional Wisdom, brought to you by Texas Restaurant Association. Virtual Texas Restaurant Association Marketplace gives your restaurant resources to weather the storm and future-proof your business. Register free for this week-long conference at tramarketplace.com/attend.
This is Ross Ramsey from the Texas Tribune. Today's column, August agenda for local government includes schools, police spending, property taxes, and a pandemic. Property valuations in Texas are supposed to be complete now that the July deadline has passed. The next step is as hard as arguing over what a house is worth as cities, counties, school districts, and all those other local governments set their budgets and their tax rates. That happens in public hearings, perhaps held in person at a time when many gatherings have moved to the tiny online boxes of Zoom, Meet, Team, WebEx, and other services most of us hadn't heard of 6 months ago. Those annual budget and tax hearings are where Texans find out what's going to happen to police and public safety budgets, to steal a talking point from this summer's justice marches and protests, and to parks and public health and the other programs and services of local government. School districts are being remade and reconfigured before our eyes as local educators contend with major changes in teaching, transportation, technology, food services, all the intricacies of sending 5.5 million young Texans to public schools 5 days a week, 180 days a year. Oh, yeah, and how to keep people in those schools, young and old, staff and student, safe from a virus that has already killed more than 6,200 Texans in less than 5 months. They'll have to figure out what that's going to cost and which taxes will pay for it, even as they're pondering the changes in their operations and the often confusing instructions they're getting from state officials in Austin. It's a chore, even in a normal year. Budgets and taxes are the meat and potatoes of government and what voters expect from it, wrapped in numbingly boring sheets of numbers. This is where public officials say what their governments will do and how much they'll charge taxpayers to get it done. Safe to say citizens will have some thoughts they'd like to share, even if it's not about the hot topics of police funding and in-person public education during a pandemic. Public budget hearings are a certainty, according to Bennett Sandlin, executive director of the Texas Municipal League. Every city has to set a budget and has to do so at a public hearing. Tax rate hearings are conditional, he says. Local officials don't have to have public tax hearings if they're not increasing their tax revenues. Only tax increases require that public input. But it all happens at the same time. Whether the calculations start with programs and services, how much will this cost? Or with price, how much money will taxes bring in? It has to balance. They do those things together at the local level, deciding at the end whether the things they want to do can be done with the money they have. If the answer is no, they choose between cutting spending and raising taxes. Simple enough, politically hazardous, and definitely the kinds of debates voters watch closely and want to take part in. It's not clear whether hearings have to be held in person or online. Lawyers for local governments are trying to sort that out, since it might mean they have to make physical spaces safe during the pandemic without making a joke of their public hearings by shutting out enough people to thwart the coronavirus. They're hoping to get some guidance from Governor Greg Abbott, who temporarily suspended the state's open meeting laws as the virus started to spread in Texas. Tax rates could be a particular point of interest in August 2020. Government revenues have fallen during the pandemic-induced recession. Even at current spending levels, that creates some pressure on budget writers who counted on a better economy to fund their operations. And a new law designed to give voters more power to limit tax increases, passed by the legislature in 2019, is now fully in effect. Cities and counties can no longer raise their property tax revenues more than 3.5% without asking voters for permission. That sounds simple enough, but lawyers always find a loophole, don't they? State law arguably raises that new limit on increases to 8% in times of disaster, and some lawyers read the definition of disasters to include epidemics. Senator Paul Bettencourt, a Houston Republican who co-authored the tax limit, has said the pandemic does not trigger the exemption, but has also said it will be a point of debate. Expect lawsuits. Either way, 3.5% or 8%, cities and counties that are increasing taxes will have to hold public hearings. Adopting local government budgets will too. They just need to let us know whether we'll need masks or laptops if we have something to say about it. This is Ross Ramsey. Thanks for listening.
And this also from the Texas Tribune. Governor Greg Abbott says local health officials can shut down schools only in limited circumstances. In a statement Friday, Governor Greg Abbott said local health authorities can shut down schools if there's evidence of an outbreak after students return to campus, but cannot shut them down weeks before schools open. His statement backs a legal opinion released by the Texas Attorney General Tuesday. But Abbott, who issued the statement with top education officials, said school districts could apply for waivers to keep their buildings closed beyond the state's 8-week maximum if they believe they need one. The Texas Education Agency will review those requests on a case-by-case basis, according to the statement. And on a related note, we'll go to our next pre-recorded report. This is from the Texas Standard. School administrators want flexibility when it comes to school reopening.
This has been no ordinary week. It's Friday, the last day of July. I'm Joy Diaz in for David Brown, and you're listening to the Texas Standard. What a week it's been as Texans get ready to go back to school. It was Tuesday that Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton issued a pandemic-related directive that said local public health authorities could not keep schools closed amid health concerns and prevent kids from attending classes in person. Then Texas Education Commissioner Mike Morath said the AG's guidance, though not binding, meant schools would not necessarily receive full state funding unless given permission if they only offered virtual classes. Then on Thursday, the Texas Association of School Administrators issued a statement. Kevin Brown is with us now. He's the organization's executive director. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be with you.
In your group's letter to top state officials yesterday, you talked about how the Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton's letter on Tuesday, I'm actually going to quote this, muddied the waters and created more confusion. And what I wonder is the current confusion mostly in regards to funding?
Certainly funding is very core to our concerns right now. But the Attorney General's letter really put into question who is able to close a school. Mm-hmm. And we know by law that a school cannot ignore a county health order unless a court overrules that or the governor overrules that. And so this letter from the Attorney General does not change that. It definitely puts some pressure on county health officials, but it is not a binding letter. Mm. It's not even an Attorney General opinion. It's a guideline that was sent to one mayor and one community. And we know some schools are very frustrated that county health departments have closed them down. Others are appreciative of that. And we just think it muddies the waters.
Well, I read the letter and it goes into so many places, including if the building is contaminated and only you can close it for as long as the building is contaminated, which is very different from the pandemic that we are going through right now. And I wonder if there's just this push and pull between state and local control. How do you see that?
Well, I think to some degree, you're right. There is a tension there. We understand completely the desire to have school in person to the degree that we can. And our educators are very anxious to have children back in school. But we also want to do it in a safe fashion. And that means we need to be able to reduce numbers of people so that we can socially distance, so we can take into account the CDC guidelines that are in place. In order to do that, though, we have to have some flexibility. So we have to be able to have children on some students on one day, some on other days potentially, or morning and afternoon. But the rules around that are so complex and confusing, and they have threatened to cut off funding to schools if they don't allow any child that wants to be in school at any time to be there. So we feel like local schools and their boards need to be able to make decisions based on the environment and the conditions in that community. But as you get into metropolitan areas, suburban areas, where the COVID outbreak is much larger, you start having concerns about bringing so many people together into a classroom or into a school building, because we need our teachers to feel safe when they come to school. And many of our teachers are vulnerable, and we just want to make sure that they have the confidence that they can go to work and be safe when they do that.
Have you heard back from any of our state leaders? Have you heard from the governor, perhaps, or Education Commissioner Mike Morath, or from Attorney General Ken Paxton? Have you heard from any of them as far as clarifying or answering to your letter?
Commissioner Morath, we speak with regularly. He, I think, has been working very hard. They've been able to stand up some very good resources for schools. We clearly haven't gotten everything we've wanted, but we do think that he has worked with us in good faith and is trying to make a difference. He does a call for all superintendents twice a week to have some dialogue there. And some of the shifting, you know, guidelines throughout the summer have been to some degree of response to the requests of schools. I think part of our concern, though, is right now we're still standing with, we don't have a guarantee of funding for schools for this coming school year. You know, we have hold harmless funding up to November, and that's 12 weeks. But our contracts with our employees, which make up about 90% of the operational budget in a school, we have contracts with all our employees, but we don't have the guarantee to fund those employees. And that's a very big cliff that we're staring at. Now, they've told us that they'll analyze the enrollment and let us know what's going on, and you know, we'll wait till September or October to figure this out. But, you know, we need guarantees. We need our teachers and staff to know that they're going to have a job this year and that they're not going to be laid off in the midst of a pandemic. This is the time when we need all of our teachers all on hands on deck, try to reduce our class sizes as much as we can and make sure that we're giving this generation of children the very best that we have during this big crisis that we're facing.
Kevin Brown is the executive director of the Texas Association of School Administrators. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Now we'll go to our next article. This is from the Austin American-Statesman, and it was published Saturday. Facing a Crisis, Abbott Charts a Lonely Middle Course by Jonathan Tillove. Last Sunday, the White House Coronavirus Task Force placed Texas and 20 other states in a red zone. The numbers from Texas were worrisome, with the rate of new cases and deaths from COVID-19 a third higher than the national average and the positivity rate for diagnostic tests at 17.3%, twice the national number. That same day, the COVID-19 Consortium for Understanding the Public Policy's Preferences Across States, a joint project of four major universities, completed its seventh wave of a large 50-state survey, placing Governor Greg Abbott in his own red zone for his performance in contending with the crisis. In late April, 61% of Texas adults surveyed not just voters as in most political polls, approved of Abbott's handling of the pandemic, 3 points below the national average for governors. By late July, a Republican whose standing had been slipping month by month as he sought to make Texas a leader in reopening the economy had a 38% approval rating, 13 points off the national average, and not all that much better than President Donald Trump's rating of 32% among Texans for his leadership in the crisis, down from 44% in April. All this scarcely 3 months before a 2020 election in which Texas appears to be truly in play, from the presidency to control of the state house. The 62-year-old Abbott, who said before all this that he planned to run for a third term in 2022, is not on this fall's ballot, but politically, everything is on the line for him. Yet there was Abbott, his tie off and top shirt button unbuttoned for casual Friday, making his usual round of appearances via his Austin TV studio on evening newscasts on this day in San Antonio, Houston, and Dallas, talking about COVID-19 and clarifying plans for reopening schools with his usual confident demeanor. His favorite locutions are "know this" and "understand this." Months into a modern plague with no end in sight, he is looking none the worse for wear. Internally doing okay also, Abbott said during a half-hour telephone interview Friday afternoon with the American Statesman from the governor's mansion. "One thing I know is that when you deal with something like this, this is a marathon," Abbott said. "I know how to run long distances. I know how to pace myself." Entering his sixth month of ceaseless crisis management, Abbott has appeared through his disaster declarations and emergency orders as, for all practical purposes, Texas's sole decider, bombarded from all sides. This is not a crisis with the saving grace of binding people together. "Both sides have hijacked this issue and distorted it because of the upcoming election," said State Representative Tom Olverson, Republican Cypress, an anesthesiologist. "People are working backward from a desired outcome, so they are scanning the internet and looking for evidence to support whatever conclusion they've already drawn." Abbott professes to be unbothered by the dissonance. "It is less hard when you understand what your focus needs to be," Abbott said, "and my focus needs to be on constantly monitoring the status of COVID, monitoring the strategies that need to be taken in response to COVID at that particular moment in time. And so if you just keep your head focused on what the priority is, what the goal is, and what needs to be done to achieve that goal, you don't really worry about all the surrounding noise. For me, the response has to be to focus on what is the science, what needs to be done to achieve the best result for the people of Texas, and take actions based upon that without worrying about the politics," Abbott said. "But the fact of the matter is, the more we control and reduce the spread of COVID-19, the better politics will be. Right now, the outcome on both scores is very much in doubt." Threading a needle. 2 weeks ago, the state Republican Party convention elected as the party's new chairman retired Army Lieutenant Colonel Alan West, a former one-term congressman from Florida, who in his convention speech characterized Abbott's COVID-19 mandates as acts of un-Texan tyranny. West hasn't let up since. "I don't want to see us get to the point where we are imposing draconian measures, measures that go against our fundamental liberties and freedoms and rights over something that has a 99.9% recovery rate," West said on Mark Davis's conservative North Texas talk radio show, a regular stop for the governor. "What about having a state party chairman who is undercutting your leadership?" the governor was asked Friday. "I wouldn't say that," Abbott replied. "Because of the platform that I have as governor, I'm able to convey to the public very prolifically about the importance of doing things like wearing a mask," he said, "and about safety standards that people need to take to make sure that they reduce the spread, but also that they protect their own lives and protect the lives of others." Abbott said he spoke to West on Wednesday in Midland, where they both were for Trump's visit. "We chit-chatted," Abbott said. "We talked and collaborated on the upcoming elections. we were sitting down charting pathways for a very successful November. University of Texas political scientist Darren Shaw, co-director of the Fox News poll, said that Abbott has a tougher row to hoe than most governors. There is the sheer size and diversity of Texas, but also where a Democratic governor such as Andrew Cuomo in New York, 71% April approval rating in the consortium survey, or Gavin Newsom in California, 58% approval, can bring government power to bear with broad public support. That kind of flexing of government muscle is deeply suspect among Texas Republicans. Likewise, it's all good in their party for Cuomo or Newsom to challenge Trump, but not at all good in his party for Abbott, who, while not close to the president, has established a mutually supportive relationship. Then, too, while Republicans control state government in Texas, Democrats rule the state's largest metropolitan areas. "I'm watching the guy trying to thread that needle," Shaw said. "He's got to walk a fine line," said Josh Blank, manager of research and polling for the Texas Politics Project at UT. "Do you evaluate how he's handled this based on some sort of idealized response from whatever position you're coming from? Or do you acknowledge the fact that he has faced constraints both from and above in the form of the president, from below in the form of the most activated and extreme grassroots of his party, and from the side by the Democrats?" Blank said. Asked to evaluate the president's varied responses to the pandemic, Abbott said, "Obviously, we look for the president for guidance, but in a medical situation, it's important to listen to the doctors. I've talked with Dr. Deborah Birx all the time. I've talked to Dr. Anthony Fauci on occasion," Abbott said, referring to the White House Coronavirus Response Coordinator and the nation's top infectious disease specialist. Also, he said, he has consulted with Dr. Robert Redfield, head of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and Dr. Robert Kadlec and Admiral Brett Guerer, both Assistant Secretaries of Health and Human Services. "My thought process about how to respond to the coronavirus is really shaped by the medical doctors that we speak to, knowing that they are the experts," Abbott said. The advice, he said, has changed over time. "There have been evolving messages from them, as well as evolving messages from the medical community in general, and there's a reason for it, and that's because we are dealing with a, quote, novel coronavirus," Abbott said. "And as a result, this is something that's dynamic in the true sense of the word. It's constantly changing. And because it is novel, and it has never been dealt with before, it was impossible at the beginning to know exactly how to respond to it, what works and what doesn't work," Abbott said. "And it did require the medical community to continue to gain more information, more insight, to figure out what does and doesn't work. And the standards today are different than the standards were back in the March time frame, just based upon gaining the knowledge from responding to COVID-19. Mixed messages. But Democrats say Abbott ignored data in reopening too quickly, and that what he is really wrestling with are his poll numbers. If the governor is trying to placate the Allen West wing of the Republican Party, well, yeah, he's going to be in knots every day, said State Representative Trey Martinez Fisher, Democrat San Antonio. And I think that's what really his problem is. There was Abbott's initial reluctance to call his March 31st stay-at-home order a stay-at-home order, and his rush to the defense of Shelley Luther, a Dallas salon owner who was briefly jailed after opening her salon before his orders allowed, and his subsequent rushing the opening of all of the state salons. "You know, he likes to play in the gray," said Martinez Fisher, who argued that Abbott has sent mixed messages, while Democratic mayors and judges offered clearer, more steadfast leadership. "The only time when our metrics with COVID seem to be working and doing better than the rest of the country is when we had our local leaders calling the shots," Martinez Fisher said. "When Governor Abbott took himself out of the equation and left it to the local leaders, that's when we had a handle on this pandemic. Ever since he has put himself back in charge of the day-to-day COVID response, Texas has seemed to suffer." It's like he wanted somebody else to shut the state down, and then he wanted to come in and be the good guy and open it back up, said State Representative Aaron Zwiner, Democrat, Driftwood. We're never going to convince some of the really robust anti-mask warriors, but it would be more obvious they were crazy if our governor were more consistent. Luke Macias, a political consultant who counts many of Texas's most conservative lawmakers among his clients, also faults Abbott for inconsistency. When it comes to the question of mandates, I stand with Governor Abbott, Macias said. Unfortunately for him, I stand with the version of Governor Abbott who, 30 days before he decided that mask mandates were constitutional, called them an infringement on Texans' individual liberty. Texans would handle any of his decisions in a much better way if he actually clearly articulated what he believes in and stuck to that, Macias said. At the end of April, as Abbott moved to reopen the economy, he recommended everyone wear a mask, even as he countermanded local authorities' efforts to mandate them. I had no issue with him wanting to open the economy, Bexar County Judge Nelson Wolf said. The only thing I had an issue with was that he also knocked out our ability to do the mandatory face masks, and I told him at the time that I thought that was a very, very bad thing because I wanted the opening to be successful. At the end of May, in time for Memorial Day, Abbott let bars reopen at 25% capacity, a decision he later said he regretted. I think we'd like to have that week of that last week of May, first week of June, to do over again, Oliverson said. I don't think anybody could have predicted the degree to which, as soon as the lockdown eased, that people would sort of pretend like it never happened and just go back about their daily lives, whether that be going to the beach or going to a bar or rafting on a river or joining 50,000 people in the streets of Houston to protest, Oliverson said. Polling by the Texas Politics Project found that between April and June, the share of Republicans who described themselves as living normally, coming and going as usual, nearly tripled from 11% to 32%. People were feeling pretty comfortable, said Dr. John Zerwas, a former state legislator from Richmond, who was one of four physicians whom Abbott chose to advise him. We didn't have a strong message on masking, frankly, and there wasn't a lot of adherence or adoption of masking. People just got back to life as we wanted it to be, frankly. And in the meantime, the virus, of course, was out there, and it's highly contagious, Zerwas said. Mask order. Abbott said that for the first month after reopening began, all the indicators were good. But by mid-June, the numbers were spiking. Once it was determined that, in fact, it was a trend, that's when it was determined that action was needed to respond to that trend, Abbott said. First, he closed the bars, with no plans to reopen them soon, despite recent stirrings of rebellion by some bar owners. Then, just before the July 4th weekend, he issued the mask order he had resisted for counties with more than 20 coronavirus cases. Except the Rio Grande Valley, where the virus has reached crisis proportions, the orders seem to have helped. New cases and hospitalizations statewide have been ebbing slightly over the past 2 weeks, even if deaths, a lagging indicator of the virus spread, have soared. The positivity rate of tests also has dipped in the past week, though it remains above 10%, a threshold that Abbott has said is cause for concern. It seems like it has worked well, Abbott said of his orders to close bars and wear masks in public. He made a good decision when he put in place the mask order, Wolf said. That was a difficult thing for him to do because he's a Republican. I'm a Democrat, and he has to deal with the right-wing wackos in his party. The move showed character, said James Huffins, a retired banker and former UT System Regent, who chairs the Strike Force to Open Texas, a special panel advising Abbott on reopening businesses in Texas. I have been fortunate to have been around a lot of the top leaders in my business and public service career. One trait I learned is that true leadership comes from a leader that can learn from changing data and then be willing to change directions if a course correction is needed, said Huffins, who lives in Dallas. That is exactly what Governor Abbott did when he closed the bars and instituted a statewide mask order. Humility is always an essential trait of lasting and strong leadership. The governor's mantra now is that wearing a mask, a habit that, according to polls, most Republicans already approve of and practice, even if many grassroots activists might not, is essential to not having to shut down the Texas economy again. He is very diligent in trying to avoid another shutdown, and not merely because of economics, but because I happen to believe in his heart, Governor Abbott just wants people to be able to get back to life normally with all these modifications, said Kevin Roberts, executive director of the conservative Texas Public Policy Foundation. Roberts, who serves on the strike force to open Texas, thinks a renewed lockdown would be devastating to the future of the Texas economy. And because of how brightly Texas shines in the national conservative firmament, would send negative shockwaves across the country. Oliverson said that it can be too easily overlooked in the current moment the devastation the initial shutdown had on Texas's health, wealth, and psyches. It was very clear that we were just absolutely devastating our economy, Oliverson said. I will tell you as a doctor that works in a trauma center, those months of April and May, we did see accidents with DUIs associated, substance abuse, domestic violence, suicide attempts. There's this balance that I think everybody's forgetting, because right now they're focused on the mortality numbers, which I would admit they look bad, Oliverson said. It's a hard argument to make, but there is another side to that. If you keep everybody locked up forever until the virus completely goes away, you may find you lost more Texans than you could have ever imagined, and certainly a lot more people would be unemployed and destitute. He is having to navigate between lives and livelihoods, said Tom Luce, founder and chairman of the Dallas-based Texas 2036, which seeks to provide data for better decision-making on this and other issues vital to the state's future. I don't envy his challenge, said Luce, who also serves on the strike force. It doesn't mean I've agreed with every step, but my goodness, there wasn't a playbook. Political implications. The political impact is hard to predict, said David Carney, Abbott's top political advisor. That partnership on this, as with everything else in the country, is wide. Democrats want to do nothing in terms of opening up until everything is safe. Republicans are more willing to take risks, Carney said. While Texas has remained open, California responded to its surge by shutting back down. But Carney notes for all the controversy around masks, in Texas, even Republicans are wildly supportive of a mask requirement. About all that is clear, Carney said, is that the pandemic is overlaid on what is now, politically, a much more competitive environment than we've had before in Texas. It's not just a matter of winning the primary anymore to be successful. Abbott reflected that COVID knows no geographic bounds and knows no political bounds. It doesn't care if a state is red or blue, Abbott said. The fact of the matter is, it just spreads rapidly anywhere, and it's going to require people not letting their guard down. It's going to require people following safe practices until we do get the medicines that are needed to be able to treat it. Asked what gets him through it, Abbott said, "It is a whole lot easier when you live one day at a time." And now we'll move back to another pre-recorded report. This is from NPR. As pandemic widens, how did we get to this point?
The coronavirus outbreak has entered a new phase in this country. That's what Dr. Deborah Birx of the White House Coronavirus Task Force is saying now.
I want to be very clear. What we're seeing today is different from March and April. It is extraordinarily widespread. It's into the rural as equal urban areas.
Birx was on CNN yesterday and stressed the need for everybody, no matter where they live, to wear a mask and to socially distance. We're going to take a step back over the next few minutes and talk about where the virus is spiking now, how we got here, and what it's going to take to turn it around. And we are joined by NPR science correspondents Nurit Eisenman and Rob Stein. Thanks to both of you for being with us this morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm going to start with you, Narit. Dr. Birx talked about how widespread this outbreak has become, moving to new parts of the country. How did we get to this point?
Yeah, remember back in February, the outbreak was small and mainly in Washington State, California. Then pretty soon the locus shifted to New York and New Jersey, where cases really blew up in early spring. But those states then went all in with strict lockdowns, such that by Memorial Day, their cases had declined to on par with the caseloads of some big southern and western states like Texas, Florida, and Arizona. And in the following weeks, New York, for instance, kept up its social distancing to push its caseload down even lower. Meanwhile, in a lot of the southern and western states like Texas, Florida, Arizona, the lockdowns weren't as robust, so cases had been sort of bubbling along at a steady rate rather than declining. And then around Memorial Day, a lot of those southern and western states started easing up on their social distancing very fast. And that's what's given rise to this current situation.
So this is really, when we talk about the virus being so widespread now, as Dr. Birx said, we're really looking at the southern and western part of the country.
Correct. When you look at the daily new infections as a percentage of the population, right now, 14 states are in the red zone, according to this rating system that a team from Harvard has come up with to flag, you know, when a state's transmission rates get so high, probably the only way to control it is to revert to some amount of stay-at-home mode. And all but one of these 14 red zone states are in the South and the West. The top five are Florida, Mississippi, Tennessee, Louisiana, and Arizona. That said, there are also now an additional 19 states just one notch below the red zone. And these orange zone states are all over the country. Iowa, Ohio, Wisconsin, North Dakota, Nebraska. By the way, for the last two, the daily case count isn't just high, it's rising. Ashish Jha is on the Harvard team that came up with this red zone rating tool. He notes that some other wealthy countries coming out of the spring lockdown are seeing flare-ups. But Jha says the U.S. situation is totally different.
What we have is not little flare-ups. We have a raging forest fire. Large parts of our country where the outbreak is just out of control.
And even in some of the states that are in pretty good shape overall, Colorado, Washington, Oregon, there are a few individual counties where transmission is in the red zone.
So I know a lot of states, though, I mean, they've been late to the mask game. Like, it took them a long time to get on board with requiring people or asking them to wear masks. But now they are. Is that helping at all?
Yeah, and in states where it isn't statewide, some cities and counties have gone ahead with that, along with other measures like closing bars. People are adjusting behavior on their own. Likely due to that, some states like Arizona have managed to slightly bend the curve. But cases and deaths there are still high. Meanwhile, in some of the hardest hit states where the masking requirements are a patchwork, cases are still on an upswing. Mississippi, Tennessee. One prominent forecasting team is, meanwhile, warning about rising case counts in areas of the Mid-Atlantic in the Northeast, like Baltimore, Philadelphia, the New Jersey shore. That alert comes from the policy lab at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. They say it's largely driven by summer travel. Yeah. Also, forecasters are warning the transmission could pick up further in autumn once the weather cools.
So what do you take away from that?
You know, scientists say it just illustrates that until there's a vaccine and that vaccine is widely deployed, this virus will remain a constant threat. It's going to take a sustained national strategy.
All right, NPR's Rob Stein has been listening in. I want to bring you into this conversation, Rob. Narit just outlined where we're at. What needs to happen?
You know, there's no question that things look pretty bleak right now. And it comes at a time when a lot of people are just kind of exhausted and fed up with the past 5 months. So it may make things seem kind of hopeless. But, you know, I spend all day talking with public health experts, infectious disease specialists, epidemiologists. They, too, can't quite believe what a mess the country's in. But they also say, look, all hope is not lost. Quite the opposite. We know what to do. We can beat this virus. We just all have to get on the same page and do it. Here's Jeffrey Shaman at Columbia.
We're all tired of it. I'm tired of it. I'm sure you're tired of it. We would much rather go back to our own lives, and we don't have people telling us that you have to socially distance and wear a face mask, and you can't go to restaurants, can't have sporting events, and you can't go to concerts, and you can't go to church. People are tired of that. That's totally understandable. But unfortunately, this is a moment of collective national sacrifice where we need to do that for the greater good.
But that same message, Rob, I mean, we've been hearing that for many months, and people are not getting it, or enough people aren't getting it. So what's the next step here?
Yeah. So, you know, first of all, people do have to finally get it. They do have to really start wearing those masks and keeping their distance from other people as much as possible, especially indoors. But beyond that, and here is the tough part, we have to shut some things back down again in a lot of places. No one wants to hear that, but unfortunately, that's the bitter pill that a lot of places they do need to swallow, especially in the hotspots Nurit mentioned, and maybe places that look like they're about to become the next hotspots. But, you know, it doesn't mean that has to go on forever, maybe 6-8 weeks if it's done right, and that could slow the spread of the virus enough to get the pandemic under control. That won't mean game over. Far from it, but at least the virus would be beaten back enough to let the country try to reopen more strategically and carefully this time without the pandemic surging out of control again.
So would a lockdown like that, akin to what we saw in the spring, I mean, would it be as strict as we did back then?
Well, you know, this is a little bit of good news. It doesn't necessarily have to be as strict. We've learned a lot about the virus. We can probably leave some things open this time, like parks and, you know, beaches and playgrounds, and go after the places and situations where the virus seems to be spreading the most. The virus is spreading too fast right now in too many places, and there still aren't nearly enough tests for testing and contact tracing to stamp it down. But if you do that as much as you can learn what to do to basically beat it back in the places where it's spreading the most, like crowded bars, maybe indoor restaurants, retail shops, certain factories, house parties, and family gatherings. And if the nation does all that and finally gets enough tests and trains enough contact tracers, it won't be like our old lives, but it'll be a lot better than the lives that a lot of us are living right now and could get kids back to school and safely let people get back to work.
Testing, contact tracing, social distancing, masks. We have heard it before. We all just have to get on board. Science correspondent Nurit Eisenman and Rob Stein, thanks to you both.
You're welcome.
You bet.
And finally, here's a look at how some Americans are dealing with the pandemic. Not flying this summer, many Americans are hitting the road in RVs. Here's this from NPR.
Flying is not all that attractive these days, but with gas prices low, travelers are hitting the road. Some of them, worried about staying in hotels and eating in restaurants, have decided to go a different way. They're taking an RV, a recreational vehicle, for the first time. Melanie Peoples has more.
Like a lot of people, Amy Holdich has never driven anything bigger than an SUV. But she's about to get behind the wheel of a 30-foot-long house on wheels. Getting their first look at their home for the next 10 days, Amy, her mom Sandra, and especially her 12-year-old son Duncan are thrilled.
Come on. This
is amazing.
Come on.
Very cool, very cool. Mm-hmm.
It looks plenty big for their trip from Madison, Alabama to Cape Cod, Massachusetts. There's a table, a kitchen, a back bedroom, even a shower and bathroom. Not to mention walls that slide out to make their living space even bigger. Cheryl Huddle is the owner of the RV.
Okay, so normally we start at the front door. We're just going to go around, and everything's been cleaned with bleach because of COVID.
You wouldn't think it, but it takes 2 hours for Huddle to show Holdich everything she needs to know. There's all the indoor stuff, how the benches turn into beds, when to hook up to electricity, when to use the generator, how to turn on the generator. Not to mention all the outside stuff, like power cord and water hookup.
All right, now we get into the meat.
Okay.
Control panel. Air conditioner.
Mm-hmm.
Where are you headed to?
This wasn't the vacation Holdich, who works as an esthetician in a salon, had planned for her family. They were all supposed to fly to Hawaii, and sure, they could have just put that off for another year. But Amy wanted something for making memories this summer.
My dad has Alzheimer's and my mom has a progressive memory loss as well. And I don't know how many trips we have left in us. You know, there's a lot of uncertainty right now. And I just kind of went with it. I just kept thinking about it and kept thinking about it. And I just kind of jumped off the cliff and did it.
That is not to say she doesn't expect challenges. But as she's navigating her new role as a single mom, she's discovering learning to overcome them is a good thing.
And so there was a little bit of uncertainty of doing it myself, but I've always been able to do it myself before, for the most part. I'm, you know, struggle sometimes, but I think I can do it.
She doesn't want to look back on this year as the year coronavirus ruined everything. Holdich is not alone. Nationwide, 3 times as many people are renting RVs this summer, according to the RV renting service RVShare. CEO John Gray says people who are leery of shared spaces are discovering what's great about RVs.
People, you know, can bring the bathroom with them. They can bring their kitchen with them. And that premium of control that has always existed in RV travel is at even more of a premium this year.
Prices run from $50 a night for a pop-up camper to $1,000 a night, depending on size and level of luxury. Despite the coronavirus, Americans certainly aren't sitting at home. The American Automobile Association, or AAA, expects 683 million car trips this summer. That's only a 3% drop from last year.
Bottom line is, Americans plan to travel.
Jeanette Casolano is a spokesperson for AAA. One thing different this summer, she says, is people have to plan ahead.
You want to plan your trip from point A to point B, not just to know how you're going to get there, but where and when you're going to make stops.
And that's exactly what Holditch has done, mapping her route all the way up to Cape Cod, making sure she won't have to quarantine along the way. Speaking of Holditch, she's gotten her last bit of RV instructions, and the family is all inside, buckled up and ready to ride.
All right, here we go, guys.
Oh, she'll be fine. No, really, she made a perfect three-point turn in reverse after that. And then they were gone, off on their big adventure. For NPR News, I'm Melanie Peoples.
Since Melanie reported that story, Amy has made it safely to Cape Cod, but says driving an RV through the Lincoln Tunnel is not something she would advise.
Weekend Edition is a production of NPR News, which is solely responsible for its content. Like a story you heard on this or another NPR program? Share it with a friend at npr.org. While there, you can also hear stories you missed, enjoy expanded content, or connect to your favorite member station.
And that is your coronavirus update for Monday, August 3rd, 2020, from the Recording Library of West Texas. Here's what's coming up next. USA Today with national news. At 3 o'clock, we'll bring you local news. Here are some of the articles that we'll be reading. From the Midland Reporter-Telegram, five nurses charged in inmate's death at jail. If we had do-over, school wouldn't be named Lee. Midland ISD to discuss re-entry policy. And seven candidates announced for MISD board. From the Odessa American, ECISD goal is to keep students fed. City council and mayor filings roll in. Man steals OPD unit, ends in officer-involved shooting. And Deusler retires after 30 years. Those are some of the articles we'll be reading locally for our 3 o'clock broadcast. At 6 o'clock, we'll... Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, USA Today, followed by the Midland Reporter-Telegram and Odessa American at 3.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 84 and clear. Tonight, partly cloudy with a low in the mid-70s. Then tomorrow, mostly cloudy with a high around 102. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the low 80s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
Coronavirus updates, weekdays at 1.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 2 p.m.
This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Mind's Eye.
Hello, it is Monday, August 3rd, 2020, and this is the USA Today newspaper for today. The headline is, U.S. failed to learn from racist hate, victims say. 23 people died in Walmart rampage that targeted Latinos. This is about the El Paso shooting 1 year later. And there's a photo with this, actually two photos. The first one is a memorial marks the parking lot in El Paso, Texas, where a man opened fire August 3rd, 2019. And it's a large tube that stands higher than the building that's lit up. And there's another small photo with a lady Looking at luminarias that are spread around the grass, marking the number of people who died. This article is by Eleanor Dearman for Corpus Christi Caller. Roberto Gerardo hid with his 88-year-old mother between toy machines at the entrance of the Cielo Vista Walmart. Lying in broken glass, he listened as the sound of gunshots drew closer. When the man with the AK-47 was only 10 feet away, that day I believe I stared death in the eyes, Gerardo said.